Welcome, friends and enemies, ladies and gentlemen. Very good to have you with us. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today. It was good to have you here, and we always hope that you learn something new, whether you are friend or foe. My name is Henrik Palmgren. I'm your host and the editor-in-chief and founder of Red Eyes. As a matter of fact, Red Eyes Radio is coming up on its 10th year here in April, and we have some exciting things planned that we'll be able to disclose and talk a bit more about here soon, so definitely stay tuned for that. If you're new to the show, make sure to check out the website, redeyescreations.com, and also redeyesmembers.com. That's where we have the full archives available for you. And today we have a conversation with Brian Rua and Alfred Schaefer lined up. Now, Brian was with us during the Canadian Roundtable we did just a few weeks ago, but in case you missed that, he used to be a monk in Thailand and has taught Buddhism since 1996 in the Vancouver, BC area. He hosts a YouTube channel, a talk show, where he challenges Zionist supremacy and also talks about the revisionist history of World War II. We also have with us Alfred Schaefer, who is a first-time guest on the show. And Mr. Schaefer has produced several videos that are aimed at exposing the brainwashing that we all have been subjected to. The lies, control words, and thought laws of today are used to herd us along, like animals, to do what the Zionist agenda wants us to do. This brainwashing has immunized the perpetrators from criticism while at the same time breaking down the self-preservation instinct and abilities of the targeted populations. Alfred is from Canada. He was born in Canada. I do believe he's from German stock. His last name is German, and I know that he lives in Germany right now as well. But we'll definitely ask him a bit more about his video production in the beginning of the show. Now, this show is really wide-ranging in topics and issues. I guess the central theme really goes around trying to break free from political correctness, self-censorship, and also the fear of discussing forbidden topics, such as ultra-Zionist extremism, World War II, inquiry surrounding Adolf Hitler, revisionism, and, of course, the seminal taboo, the Holocaust. But we're also going to go into the migration crisis, so-called, in Europe, displacement of the European population, and white genocide. So, you know, this is really a show where we try to hit some of the most sensitive, controversial, and, well, really difficult subject for the masses out there to even accept talking about, all at the same time. So, I guess if nothing else, I do hope that it helps to desensitize you at the very least and lead you to dare to question everything and break free from the mind prison that is the self-censorship and inability to inquire and research just because everyone else says that you're not supposed to. Stay tuned. Enjoy. Brian Rua, welcome back. Thanks for coming back so soon again. We didn't really get a chance to speak so much when you were on for the Arthur Topham Roundtable show that we did a couple of weeks ago, and I, well, was really curious just to hear more about your work, a little bit more about you, so yeah, thanks for coming back and joining us once again.
Well, great to be here, Hendrik, thank you.
You bet, thank you. And we also have with us Alfred Schaefer. Thank you for coming on, Alfred. We spoke over email briefly, and you reached out also after the Canadian Roundtable that we did, so it's good to have you with us. Thank you for coming on.
Well, it's all my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, thank you. We have some important topics lined up today, some heavy, difficult, and controversial subjects, as that's something new, right? And, yeah, I really want to go deep into that today, from World War II to the current state of Europe, the lack of leadership, and also both your interests in revisionism and control of language and ultimately people's mind through using the right words, political correctness, and the kind of social engineering and conditioning that we're seeing in the world today. But Alfred, can you just tell us about some of the main issues and topics that you've been concerned with and covering in some of your videos?
Well, the main topic I'm interested now, the topic that interests me the most now is how this brainwashing of entire societies can be so effective. But the road that got me here was a long road, and I really got involved intensely with the infamous event of 9/11. And then I just dug deeper and deeper, and the deeper I dug, the uglier it got. And I knew that the situation was going to keep getting uglier, and we're not at the end of the road yet. We're at the beginning of actually something quite monstrous and awful, and that's why we are doing what we're doing. And I think that understanding how brainwashing works is an important part of getting ourselves out of this condition.
How long have you been doing videos for?
Well, my first video was my 9/11 gatekeepers and controlled opposition video, which I resulted from an exchange I had with Noam Chomsky, and I put that video up on the end of May 2013.
All right, very good. Yeah, so a couple of years.
2014. Pardon me. Yeah.
14. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, 14.
It's still a couple of years. We're in 2016, right. Believe it or not.
Yeah.
It's going way too fast. Brian, how about you? Tell us a bit about some of the passions that you have in terms of your work and what you've been really digging deep into the last few years.
Yeah, I guess my main emphasis now is the problem of Jewish supremacy in the world. I think of this as the single biggest problem of the world, and I got into this through studying revisionist history of World War II. That's a big interest of mine. I've been professionally, I've been teaching Buddhism for the last 20 years. I was a Buddhist monk in Thailand about 20 years ago. That's been my main interest. But around 10 years ago, I started studying the New World Order from actually, it was originally a Canadian Buddhist monk was telling me about the banking system and the Rothschild. So then I started watching YouTube videos. So throughout the last 10 years, I've been seriously getting into this. But it's around 2011, I discovered more of the ethnic Jewish supremacist fabric behind all this. So that's been my main dwelling the last, I guess, 4 years now.
Is there a kind of a, in your mind, a clear link between Buddhism and National Socialism?
Well, I thought about that because the Buddha himself taught his teachings. He described as Dhamma, which means a natural law or natural truth of the way things really are. He said it's something that he discovered. He did an event. Whereas National Socialism, Adolf Hitler described also as natural law, like living with harmony with nature and man being in harmony with natural laws. So I don't know if there's a direct relationship or a direct correlation there, but I don't think it's contradictory, actually. That's something I'd like to study more, like National Socialism and Buddhism, but I think they actually can work well together.
Yeah, I mean, I thought there was a kind of an undercurrent, a link somewhere in terms of some of the expeditions of the Ananarba and whatnot. They went to Tibet, and apparently there is some kind of more ancient, I guess, Aryan link to Buddhism, but I really don't know that much about it, to be honest. I've heard a bit about it, though.
Well, yeah, the Tibetan connection is every year since 1926, actually, the National Socialist Party sends exhibitions into Tibet. This is even before they came to power because they were interested in the Aryan roots in Tibet. They thought maybe the Aryan roots came across Europe and somehow survived into Tibet. That's the idea of the Thule Society, the early formation of the National Socialist Party. So, yeah, the Germans had a real respect for Tibetan Buddhism, and also they're interested in perhaps some of the higher realm teachings or higher realm powers or tapping into that kind of cosmology, you know, understood in Tibetan Buddhism.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, definitely. Now, I'm just curious, as I know, do you still, Brian, do you sport the mustache?
Yes, I'm actually wearing a Hitler mustache and having it for 2 months now.
Wow.
And I just trying to see how people would react. And I seem to be getting away with it. People don't say anything in public.
Oh, really? Really?
So, yeah.
So no kind of like just outrageous responses to it yet?
No, in public, only once has anyone said anything. This is someone on the bus who he seemed to be a bit strange. Like he was mute. He just was pointing to my mustache and saying, oh, you shouldn't do that, but didn't actually say anything. So I really had no reactions in public, so now I've decided to keep it. I'm quite happy to wear it. I sort of did it tentatively, but I'm happy to wear it. So
funny.
I'm getting away with it.
You know, I wonder if they will ban facial hair at some point. Well, as things are developing, I guess it wouldn't be that shocking, right?
Yeah, we'll see. Canadian laws, I think Canada is kind of repressive state in a way.
Well, you know, like it's a hate mustache, right?
Well, you know, that mustache, just like we have control words, these are control symbols.
Exactly,
control, yeah.
And these symbols are, or control words and control symbols are designed to channel your thoughts in the intended direction.
Yeah.
Yeah, indeed, exactly. Well, why don't we just kind of dive into that deep end of the pool, if you will, a bit, Alfred, and kind of talk a bit more about your work in terms of, you know, some of the things that you've been seeing when it comes to how, well, I guess it's really, if we look at the problems, how this manifests itself, at least in my opinion, it is that we have people who are unable and incapable of thinking clearly. They have been subjugated. by political correctness. They are afraid. They can't express their, of course, not their opinions openly. But of course, at this point, I think it's even censorship of their own thoughts or whatever. How would you describe the mechanics of that, Alfred?
Yeah, that's a very good point. Very good question. That is, in fact, how they are controlling the discourse. Is they have you have to think of these control words, whether they are political correctness or Nazi or anti-Semitic. These are like filters or gates that they have basically engineered into our thought processes to stop or channel our thoughts, and they will always be channeled in the direction that they want them to go. And this is, in my last brainwashing video, I had this Yuri Betsbinov. The most important parts of his interview, which he held in 1985. And this was a top level KGB. He took off from the Soviet Union and he came to the United States. And in this interview, he basically told the Americans what is happening to their society and how a society is subverted. And he said that after the society is demoralized to a certain point, you can shower someone with facts and evidence, and they cannot come to any sensible conclusions with this evidence. And we have reached that point already a long, long time ago. And these control words, or in Brian's case, the control mustache, these things are designed to jolt people out of any kind of clear thinking that they might have had into a certain direction. And what has happened is the supremacist Jews have basically inoculated themselves from any criticism with these control words, and they have at the same time broken down our natural self-preservation and survival capabilities with the same control words. You see, so if we want to protect ourselves from the invaders coming into Europe now, then we are immediately labeled as a Nazi who has no passion for refugees. But if you look at what is actually happening, these are not refugees, these are invaders. When you've got 90% of them military-aged mercenaries, basically, or jailbirds, and like the people, they've emptied their prisons in some of the African countries and sent them all up to Europe. I mean, these people are not here to do us a favor, and they are not refugees, they are invaders, and yet we are not allowed to call them that without being labeled a Nazi or something like that. Yeah. So these are control words, basically, to completely stop any clear analysis and thought.
So how did they get us to this position? I mean, obviously there's been preparation for a long time. They've been working on this for years, breaking down this, associating any kind of sensible form of discrimination, sensible form of making determinations of what's good and bad for the group, for the family, for the nation. You know, that's in the bigger level. How did they get us to this point?
Yeah. This is a very slow process, and it begins in a very harmless way. Like it started basically, for most people in the West, it started slowly after the end of World War II. For the Germans, of course, it started very dramatically and long before World War II, actually. But for the rest of us, it started after World War II, when sufficient time had passed after World War II, and they started bringing in these ridiculous stories of a Holocaust. They had to let a certain amount of time pass before they started these stories, because if they started them too soon, then you would have had too many people raising their hand and objecting, because they'd said, well, that's just not true. So once, if they waited, because like the Holocaust stories, for example, most of them, I think it really got going in the 60s or 70s or something like that. It was quite a while after World War II. Although they already had the confessions by torture from the Nuremberg trials, they waited enough time pass before they really got the propaganda grind going, and then they keep amplifying this propaganda, and people didn't really notice what was happening, but they just started forming these opinions, and they thought, well, it must be true because I'm hearing it from all over the place. And that's the slow process. It just eats itself into our consciousness. or subconsciousness, into our complete thought patterns. And it just gets more and more and more until it reaches the hysterical level that we see today.
It's very tricky, you know. It's okay. So let's say, without getting into the nitty-gritty of the evidence that points to this, and we certainly can't bring up some of that. So I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying I'm trying to get to a point where how do you prime someone to be able to just, you know, examine and talk and look at the kind of material that you're talking about here? Do you think, Alfred? Because that seems to be the most difficult point. I think that we have to, you know, constantly justify. I made that mistake a while back. I did a show on this topic of the of what happened at Auschwitz, and I forgot for a moment that, you know, that we've done shows about this for about 2 years or so, and we've been kind of slowly been building ourselves up to this point. And the mistake that I make was basically by not doing a super long preface and a disclaimer and basically trying to prep the mind of the listener, which was my fault. I recognize that. But at the same time, part of me felt I'm just also kind of sick and tired of having to deal with this subject with cotton gloves, right? As someone said, it's a third rail. Touch it and you die, right? So why is that? Why is it that we have to beg for forgiveness almost as a reason to even be allowed to touch that subject? How did it get that status?
Well, that's where I have basically for myself, I say I do not subscribe to thought laws, to truth laws, or anything like that. And come what may, if we do not stand up and are able to present the facts, present the truth, then everything else that comes, because we are subordinating ourselves to thought laws, is going to be pure hell and so much worse. If you look at the long-term agenda that the Jewish supremacists have in store for us, if you want to get a taste of what that would be like, you only have to go back in history and see how the Russian people suffered after these Khazars, well, they call themselves Jews, so I'll call them Jews as well, what they did in Russia after they took over. If you look at what they did with Europe, if you look at Dresden, the firebombing and so forth, and if you see what is going on now with essentially the white race, I mean, after the phenomenal success of ripping the heart out of the center of Europe with what they did to Germany, through the countries they controlled, which was the England, Russia, and the United States. I mean, so they totally demolished Germany for the audacity of standing up to this Jewish supremacism. Then you can see how much empathy they have and how kindly they're going to treat us when they get more and more power. And that's why I say that and more people are waking up to the fact that understanding that we have to stand up and face down all of their lies, otherwise our life will become pure hell as they advance their agenda. And all these migrants or all these invaders flooding into our country now is part of this agenda. And that's what people have to start to understand, that all these events, whether it's the Hollow Hoax, whether it's 9/11, whether it's the Russian Revolution, and the invaders coming in now, all these events are tied to the same source, basically, and that is Jewish supremacism on its long road to subjugate all of us. And that's where I say that the price that we may pay for holding up the truth, well, that's the price we have to pay. There's no choice. But the thing is that that for every person they take down now, there are dozens of new ones coming up. For example, I just got a note the other day from a person by the name of, Hoffenmeier. His name is Henry Hoffenmeier, I think it is. And he has written an open letter. He published it on the internet, and he had sent this out to hundreds of top officials, the captains of all our major institutions, the military, the police, the different government institutions, and he is basically laying out the lies of this Hollow Hoax and where it leads to. And so now they're starting to give him a hard time, but I'd never even heard of him until just a few days ago, and then I see what he has done, and it's fantastic. And so these things are coming up now at an ever faster rate. like these kinds of people with great integrity who see through the lies. And the only way we can get more and more people coming out is by connecting the dots for them, helping them to understand our predicament and how we got there. And that's why, and that's where I have to say thank you to you, Henrik, for what you're doing, because you're doing a fantastic job of getting this information out there.
Well, we're trying. You know, we're trying to have people develop the courage to question it and to look at it for themselves and to walk away from this idea of self-censorship. I mean, I know that many people, they are still, you know, firmly made up, right? They're firmly, they're stand solidly in what they believe regarding history and all that kind of stuff. And all, of course, that we can really beg these people to do at the end of the day is to look at the material that we, make available, right? And try to enlighten these people. I think it's such an important topic because it hinges so much on why we've allowed ourselves to get to the point of where we are today by guilt and by being instilled that somehow we carry an extra responsibility for this. And as you said, Alfred, if we speak up against this, if we, speak up against the genocide of our people, we now are associated with the worst imaginable crime throughout human history, right? And this is what they have been using against us as a weapon. So for that reason alone, we have to examine this. We have to break it down, basically, and look at it and say, is it accurate? Is it truthful, the accusations they've made against us, or is it built on lies, right?
Yeah, I'll tell you, like, one thing I see as being our challenge, and we have to understand it, and it's not that difficult then, is we have to market this. Like, we really have to market market the idea to people that they have to come to the side of truth, because everything else is an illusion. It's an illusion of security, because this illusion is fast crumbling. And this is a very cultist thing. I call it the hollow cult. The supremacist Judaism they have their hollow hoax. I call it the hollow cult, and they have instilled in us a cult of guilt. So here we have the hollow cult surrounded by the cult of guilt, and the guilt is being amplified and amplified as we go along. And why is it that nobody talks about the details of 9/11, but we are getting inundated with ever more tales of the hollow hoax all the time? You see, like, the one is like, I don't know how many years back, and it seems to be so important, and 9/11 is only 15 years ago, and it seems to be not important at all anymore, you know?
Right, yeah.
So, and also a point I always bring up to people that do not want to understand are several points. First of all, when people do understand, it becomes unbearable for these, like for myself, for example, to sit in a room with somebody who does not want to or cannot understand. Because when you do understand, and the evidence is so obvious, it's in your face, and this is the first time, because of the availability of it on the internet, and you know, there's a lot of disinfo there, but anybody with a functioning brain can normally figure out what is truth and probably true and so forth. And the official stories are blatant lies. So anybody, if I'm sitting in a room with somebody who does not want to understand, I feel like I'm sitting there with somebody who's not even got a brain in their head. And this is the feeling that is spreading more and more. And evidence of that is the fact that people are now openly talking about two languages. They say we have a private language, which we talk with our friends, and then we have our public language, which we use in the open. And this is a symptom of a system just before it snaps. Because when everybody knows the secret and everybody's pretending they don't know it, then it only takes a spark to get everyone to just come out with it. And that's where we are right now. And then I tell people, don't waste a single day. Find the courage, face the facts. If you don't understand them, then allow yourself to learn the facts. Do not block off, because when you call someone an anti-Semitic Holocaust denier because they want to talk about 9/11, then it's not being serious anymore.
Right, exactly. Well, I think you're right there. I think people are distanced by information, by lack of information, on one hand, and then access to the information on other, truth-seeking mentality, basically, which can take people, light years apart, basically, because of that there's access to so much information right now. But, okay, I wanted to switch over to you, Brian, and some of the things you mentioned, Alfred, is obviously is what we can look into further here as we go, as we continue this program.
Yes.
We haven't really talked about any of the facts or evidence of this yet, so we'll get to that. So bear with us, ladies and gentlemen, here. But Brian, tell us a bit about your struggle, kind of daring to look into this, the challenges that you met along the way, and some of the things that you faced.
Yeah, first I want to comment. I agree with what Alfred was saying, and I thought one way of talking to people, like the question is, how do we talk to people? I talk about in terms of, well, we know governments lie to us. I often use the example of President Kennedy's assassination. There's the official story, but now 90% of the American population agree that there was a conspiracy within the government. Like, most people accept that. So I often start with that. Well, you understand they lied to us about the Kennedy assassination. They lied to us about 9/11. So then I take them back, well, when did this begin? Then I take them back to World War II, and then also talk about, look at who actually controls the media, like the six corporations that control most of our mainstream media, and that's controlled. So you impress upon people that you can't trust the mainstream media. And now with the internet, like, ignorance is a choice. There's a free availability of information on the internet. So I start people in that direction and sort of see how they respond, then maybe go more into things like, you know, the real true history of World War II. I just want to comment that.
Isn't that the one of the most hot potatoes that there is, really, though? I mean, that's really the subject where you have, not these days, I mean, it's starting to change, so let's be honest about that. But nonetheless, there's an incredible conformity on that, both on the kind of the left-right political spectrum, etc.
Yeah.
Everyone can compete of who is the most, you know, Nazi, or who is the most like Hitler, right? That's the go-to guys when it comes to villainy, I guess.
Yeah, that's like the moral benchmark of age is the Holocaust and World War II, so
yeah.
That's a big one to tackle, but that's sort of getting at the heart of the matter, yeah. But yeah, you're asking sort of how did I get into this, or what are my current struggles? Yeah, well, what's happened with me is I think that the state of Israel basically has got me fired from my job. It was the organization B'nai B'rit, which is a Jewish Masonic organization. They made a move against me just in September of last year, 2015, to get me fired from teaching. I was teaching at Capilano University in Vancouver, also at the Burnaby School Board and four Vancouver community centers. I teach night school courses on mindfulness, meditation, and Buddhism, and teaching for almost 20 years here in Vancouver. And I was in a local newspaper story. We have a local newspaper called the Georgia Strait, and they did a story on me actually getting fired from Capilano because of my YouTube videos. So I'm very vocal. I've got like about 800 YouTube videos, and about 200 of them are devoted to the issue of Jewish supremacy, the truth about World War II. So this became a story in the press, so that's kind of when the shit hit the fan. This was on August the 28th, and then on their blog, this wasn't published in the newspaper, it was published on their website. They had about 70 comments from people. Most of them pretty much agreed with me getting fired, that I was kind of a Nazi. That's how they depicted me.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a comment by Harry Abrams. He's like the local representative administrator with B'nai B'rit here in British Columbia. He's in our capital city of Victoria. I'm in Vancouver, and he stated right on the blog that this unsavory character, I'm going to write to the Parks Board and have him fired. So 2 weeks later, on September the 16th, I got a call from Doug Taylor at the Vancouver Parks Board. He's like the administrative recreation for our community centers here, and he announced that they've canceled all my classes for the fall term at four community centers, but he wouldn't say the real reason why. He came up with a different reason, and the Burnaby School Board came up with another reason, and the Capilano University, they all came up with different reasons, but they wouldn't say the real reason.
And how did this pan out at the end then?
Well, they immediately dropped my positions, but, you know, I decided to challenge this. I went through, we have the British Columbia Human Rights Commission. They have like a human rights clinic where they take on cases and they decide whether they would do it free of charge to represent you. So I went through this filing process with them, but they decided they couldn't take my case because part of the reason I said I felt I was discriminated was for religious views, because I have a Buddhist view that the force of the international Jews is working basically through the force of Mara. In Buddhist cosmology, you have the idea of the evil one, kind of like the devil, is Mara. So it is actually my view, and some Buddhists feel this way, that this force of Mara is working through international Jewry. So they said I didn't thoroughly explain my reason enough. And this, again, is something that I can appeal. So the Human Rights Commission decided not to, back my case. So this is still in progress, and I've been working with Paul Fromm, who was on our show weeks ago. He's the director of the Canadian Association of Freedom of Expression. We've done a few YouTube videos with thousands of hits talking about this. So it's putting a bit of pressure on Capilano University. We're using the alternative media to take a bit of a case out of it.
Right, exactly. Well, even personal opinions to the side, of course, it is interesting that this is the one topic that you really aren't allowed to look into and examine in greater detail, especially, of course, if you're in a position of being a teacher or having some kind of influence over people or contact with young people and whatnot. They're extremely, extremely afraid of this to get out of the bag, I think. And I think that's because much of the evidence, as many who've been looking into it have found, is because it's just so many holes in it, right? The stories are so full of holes that if you begin to... Yeah, go ahead, Albert.
What I want to say here is, Brian is... right on there. This is another part of the psychopathic, another psychopathic characteristic. They project their own characteristics on their victim or intended victim. And that is why they cannot afford to let anybody look into the details of World War II. Because if you look at the details, the empirical evidence or the provable historical facts and the empirical evidence, you will quickly come to the conclusion that everything we think we know about the Nazis is actually true for the Jewish supremacist who, and Hitler had seen through what was happening in Russia and what the communists, they were called communists back then, what they were doing to Russia and what they intended to do with the rest of Europe and actually the rest of the world. And he was the, basically, he organized the German peoples and many people from other countries who were fighting with the Germans against this communism. That's what it was. But Germany lost, and that's when the atrocity propaganda set in, and all the characteristics of what the Jews had done to the Russians and so forth, or the Khazars had done to the Russians, they projected that onto the Germans, and they amplified it and amplified it after the war until we are at the point today where you are not even allowed to question it. But no matter what the laws they create for preventing us from looking at it, nothing will change what history actually was. And now, of course, this is breaking out all over the place, and these lies are crumbling as fast as WTC7 on 9/11 did. And that's the situation we have. In fact, almost the Jews they turn everything on its head, not just the historical facts, but the words and the language. So that's what makes it so hard for people to even figure out what's going on, because everything that they do, or they turn everything on its head, making it impossible in their framework to try to come to sensible conclusions.
Yeah, and it was very interesting when I learned about the Rhinemeadows, Eisenhower's open-air prison camps, basically.
Yeah, the Rhinemeadow camps, About 1 million German soldiers, starved to death, weren't given food or shelter or water, died of exposure.
Yep, they held back on the food to deliberately starve them and freeze them to death. So the real Holocaust was perpetrated against the Germans, and the Germans are not even allowed to think about it. They're not allowed to shed a single tear about it, but they're supposed to pay up every day and every year for the Holocaust against the Jews, which never even happened. And that's a sorry state of affairs. And because of the phenomenal success they had with that, it just emboldens them to do it again and again and again. I mean, if you look at 9/11 and how much the Americans are being bled to death because of that, it seems that the countries that are the most generous to their Jewish population are the ones that they bleed and milk the very worst.
That's strange.
If we look at it, that's the result.
Yeah, that's strange, because as I learned more and more about it, I realized also, of course, that the Germans had a very elaborate campaign to keep these people alive, of course, in the camps of the delousing attempts and everything else, and that they actually were in a position where they needed them for the workforce. And, as you said, Alfred, when you begin to piece this together, you realize that it's kind of not entirely, but it's more or less a complete reversal that has been made in the situation, just as you said.
a total reversal. And, yeah. And I also explain to people how this is done. It's so easy. You take a picture, any picture. You take a picture of a huge pile of bodies, you know, and then you write something beneath it, and then people will start believing that. So, because people will often say, the Holocaust is just a figment of someone's imagination. It never happened as the way they officially state it. And they say, yeah, but what about the pictures? I say, well, what about the pictures? Did you see those two towers coming down on 9/11? And what did they tell you? That 19 Muslims with box cutters put them down. Yeah, there were two towers, or actually three towers that came down at free fall speed. So there's a picture and a narrative, but the narrative has nothing to do with the actual flow of events when that happened. And then that's how they do it. That's what brainwashing is. And if you keep repeating the same lies over and over again, starting in school, going on through to the Hollywood movies, and everywhere you go, and finally passing laws that making questioning these laws is illegal, well, then you've done a good job. But then along comes the digital age, and we have not lost our capacity and ability to think, and we start to dissect these lies, and that's where we are right now. It's a unique moment in human history.
Yeah, I want to add one thing that I agree with what Alfred was saying. Another thing about Eisenhower, when they liberated the concentration camp of Dachau, Eisenhower went in there with the psychological warfare department. They set up a table, and they put in lampshades. He said, this is made out of human skin, the shrunken heads, and the Soviet state is made out of Jewish fat. So this is something that was planned in advance. They planned the Holocaust narrative. They had the lampshades. But now everyone agrees that this was false, like the Jews themselves, the Holocaust. I was at the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. They admit that it was false. There was no lampshades, the shrunken heads, the soap. They admit it wasn't true. But Eisenhower himself was right at the front edge of the psychological warfare department setting this up. So I think one of the ways they thanked Eisenhower for this is they managed to make him president of the United States in 1953. So another, they also congratulated or thanked him for the Rhineland metal camps killing a million Germans. No, after they surrendered. So I think that's sort of how he became president, because he was going along with their agenda.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. Now, the strange thing here, too, though, is that the perception is that, you know, even if we can argue here about these various kind of components of what altogether becomes the Holocaust, we can, for example, look at the revisions of the numbers at some of the concentration camps, etc., and we realize that, oh, wait a minute, you know, 1 year they just pulled back on like a million and a half people and stuff like that. But I think the main perception is, well, that doesn't matter because it still is such a great crime, right, that it doesn't deserve a retraction. But then when you begin to analyze it, you realize that, wait a minute, but all these things piled together is what makes up the great crime, right? But then when there's holes in these stories, there's exaggerations, you begin to wonder, okay, if they lied about this, what else did they lie about? What more are we not being told about and all that stuff? So it's like people have to realize that it's, you know, it is these small individual things that make up the whole thing overall. But it's so difficult to convey this to people who have been, as you said, Alfred, before, they've been so conditioned about this that they can't look at it. They fear to look at it. They don't want to be associated with it. And they run literally in the other direction when you begin to talk about that. So it's extremely difficult.
Yeah, I've lost friends over this too. Yeah, it's true. It's hard to talk about. I've lost friends or some friends they just can't discuss it because it's such a big block in people's minds. It's like a big moral benchmark of the 20th century, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, when they came out and realized that the Earth was not a flat, I've heard it often stated that it was not so hard to accept that the Earth was round as it was to accept that the Earth was not flat, something you believed all your life. And see, that's the whole thing. They do not want to believe that – they do not want to accept the fact that they were sucked into believing these lies. That's the whole thing. But then I tell the people, you know, you don't have to believe it now, but when everybody else figures it out, you don't want to be the last one either. So you might as well get over it. Just get over it and look at the facts. Get over this brainwashing because – it is the way it is. It was imposed on you. You have no fault in this. But the shame factor, you think you can call me any name you want, but you are going to have to deal with an intolerable shame factor when you find out that you are the last person that knows. Because then you are going to have to prove your loyalty to humanity, and then you will become a dangerous person. In fact, you will be the one that's going to go off and, you know, torch a synagogue or something, which nobody should do. But those people that come on board at the end are the ones who are going to be the most angry, I can imagine. Because the truth is the truth, And there's nothing you can do about it. You know, you can write fiction stories, but you cannot change historical truth. You cannot change it. It is a, you know, facts are facts. And now these lies are, they're eroded. They're over. It's game over for them. Even if there's still a lot of people that don't want to acknowledge that, these lies are out. They're dead.
It definitely is changing a bit, I'd say, in the last couple of years. There's been a tendency. I also think it's about a kind of a liberation from the topic itself. I've seen this as a huge issue. It's same way you can say, actually, about political correctness and many of these other things that, you know, you're not allowed to, for example, feel, you know, pride as a white person, God forbid, if you state that, etc. There are many of these kinds of taboos, but what I see as an important component to this, whether really what one ultimately believes at the end of this, I think it's such an important process to begin to dare to question this. It's almost like a threshold that once you've passed over that and realized that you're like, okay, actually, this is a subject just as any other, right? It's on par with the Armenian genocide. It's on par with you know, what happened in Russia. Well, not in terms of course, numbers and what really happened, but I'm saying the emotional impact of the subject in terms of human life lost and an atrocity, etc. It's on par with so many other events. However, again, we are to hold special value for this one case. But so my point is, it's really, you know, liberating in that regard to basically just be able to discuss it as anything else. And I think that's an important component in us breaking free from that restraint and that mind lock that you talked about, Alfred.
It's extremely liberating. And that's what I also tell people, is that as long as you chain yourself to these lies, they're going to get worse and worse. The chains are going to get heavier and heavier. And once you liberate yourself, just open your mind. Don't pay attention to all these control words such as political correctness, such as anti-Semitic, Holocaust denier. I mean, these are all control words to keep you from preventing thinking clearly. I want to ask you a simple question here, all the viewers. How can it be politically correct to blame the Germans for something that they provably did not do, but it is not, you know what I mean? Like, and it's politically correct to worship the Holocaust cult, if you will, and to blame the Germans for something. How can it not be hate speech to blame the Germans for mass murdering when it didn't? If I blamed your father for mass raping or mass murdering, that would be hate speech. It would be legitimate hate speech because he did not do it. But if I'm spreading stories like that, that's hate speech. And yet, it is not defined as hate speech to blame the Germans for something they provably, demonstrably did not do.
Good point.
Yeah, do you want to add something more to that, Brian?
Well, I agree with that. It's the way the language is being used. I know in Canada, the truth is no defense, because if your speech hurts people's feelings, like if it hurts the Jews' feelings or it's interpreted as hate, or people might interpret it as hatred towards the Jews, then even in a court of law, Canada, truth is no defense.
Yeah, that's pretty bizarre, because anybody can say my feelings are hurt. I can say it hurts my feelings if you breathe. I mean, so are you supposed to stop breathing?
Well, and isn't that kind of also now being extended to other groups that with the multicultural societies that are developing now, particularly in the West, we have a scenario where all these little smaller interest groups that at least for now are minorities within our countries, but that it's almost like a layer of protection of certain taboo topics. I feel it's almost like a way for them to kind of paint white native Europeans into a corner, to not express themselves, not be able to have any interests that actually is beneficial to their own group.
Actually recently Prime Minister Trudeau, or new Prime Minister in Canada, said Canada is not a nation. Because we're multicultural, they encourage people to come here to maintain their own cultural identity, even to maintain their own language. Our own prime minister said Canada is not a nation, because he's one of these cucks. He's putting the interests of others against his own people.
Yeah.
So that shows you the force of multiculturalism in Canadian society. We've just surrendered to multiculturalism.
Yeah. I'll tell you what I see this agenda being. This agenda is being to atomize all. There will be no more nation states, no more group that can pull together to ever become a threat to international Jewish supremacism. If that's the only group left and they have all the money and all the weapons and everything else has been atomized, then of course there's no challenge coming from anywhere because it's all chaos everywhere. But you also have to keep in mind that no great things have ever come from a hodgepodge of chaos. Great things come from cohesive nations that have a common purpose and a common bond, and they are then able to invest their energies and imagination in wonderful things. Like if you look at the big cathedrals or you know, all just the big things that have come up. They've come up from functioning nation states and not from hodgepodge masses of squabbling peoples. And this melting pot, I mean, that's what's happening in the United States and ever more places, is people are living in fear and distrust and trying to just get through to the next day. Nothing great comes out of places, you know, this kind of constellation.
And Alfred, let me add something to that quickly here, because they might have a goal, of course, to dilute us all, if you will, to smoosh all the different colors in the crayon box into, you know, one mess to eradicate those differences, basically. But as things stand right now, I mean, the Han Chinese, they're fine on their own, right, as they are the Pakistanis, the Indians, the Angolans, or the Nigerians. I mean, these are not multicultural places, at least not at this stage. So it's only us, right?
It's only the white countries. The Western white countries are all targeted for multiculturalism. If you're African, you can still go to an African country and it's all black. If you're Chinese, you can go to China, it's all Chinese. If you're white, you can go nowhere anymore that's going to be all white, because you will be forced to integrate with the masses of everybody who's destitute and broke and wants to come to your country. And if you object, you're a Nazi or something like that. So it's basically, after dealing very effectively with the Germans and extorting them to the limits, the same game plan is now in place for the whites, basically.
Brian, anything to add?
Yeah, I'd say that shows there's a Jewish supremacist agenda behind it. Since this is only aimed at white countries, it's not aimed at other countries, it shows you what's the plan. There's an engineering behind that. So if you trace it back, it's Jewish supremacist engineering aimed primarily at their enemy. The whites is their main enemy for global domination. So it shows you it's not a common policy throughout the world. The biggest hypocrisy is the state of Israel itself is you have to be Jewish to immigrate there. You know, so their policy is to screen out non-Jews, so they have the opposite policy for themselves that they promote in all the white countries of the world.
Now, explain that a bit more. Both of you feel free to jump in here, but obviously for someone who's on the street level, and I encounter this, for example, in Sweden all the time, which is understandable, right, in the first level. And I know that our listeners are up to speed, so I'm not directly talking to you guys who are regulars, but it's important that we always tie things back again to the origin point and bring new listeners up to speed. So my point is, they can see in Sweden, for example, that there is a Muslim takeover of our countries, right? And many can also be very one-dimensional in that way, that they react, understandably, to what's happening right in front of their eyes, right? So that when you try to raise this idea that somehow it's a Jewish plot, all this that's happening, they you know, they look at you like you know, you just landed from Mars or something. You know, it's like this is not what they're seeing and experiencing in front of their own eyes. They're seeing a very different culture taking over and moving in and et cetera. So explain that a bit to us, guys, in terms of how you got on that trail to realize that it's their agenda that's behind this.
Do you want me to explain that? I'll explain to you. Just like at the end of my last brainwashing video, I have the guy who puts that together very nicely. He says, Jews do not fight their own wars. They get other people to do it for them. You see, and this is a perfect case for that, because when they set out on this agenda, that was basically when they took over Russia in the Russian Revolution. Actually, it was before that, but that was the first real visible step. And for then, at that point in time, that was when Germany, Adolf Hitler, saw the threat, and he knew he had to stop this. And because their ambition was at that time to maybe not do it from Moscow, but do it from Berlin, like take Germany and just take the world from there. Okay, so it got slowed down a bit. They did Russia. It was communist Russia, and a lot of the Eastern European countries, they got all that territory. And And then at the same time, they were steadily infiltrating the West. Like, they had all these people going into the United States and so forth, infiltrating the entire society. So they played both sides. They had communism and democracy. Now, if the, communism, that was a communist dictatorship. And on our side, they just infiltrate all the parties. All the parties sing from the same songbook. I mean, it's so blatantly obvious now. It's pathetic. And their next goal is to deal with the remaining white nations, because after that they figure the rest of the world is no problem. But even there they have miscalculated, because the Chinese will never fall for these nasty, dirty tricks. In fact, the Chinese say the reason we like the Jews so much is we can learn from them. They control the Americans, and we want to learn from them how they do it.
I've heard too, and please stay on track there, and then I want to get your take on this too, Brian, but just to pick up on that point, I heard this too somewhere. I forget exactly where it was now. I read about this, but basically that the Chinese, it's interesting when you can have kind of an more impartial observer from the outside looking at things. And as far as I understood the situation, they have just more or less openly realized that, oh, okay, there's like tons of Jews in influential positions in America. And we, when we look at all these things from AIPAC to the various political movements and the Congress and, you know, stuff like that, they are in a tremendous position of power and control. So they can see that from the outside. And one of their curiosities, I guess, was, just as you said, to actually investigate this in more detail and try to figure out, how did this happen? What can we learn from them? Or what happens if they're trying to do this in our country, etc.? So it's quite interesting when you have a culture that's kind of removed from ours that can see this in a very impartial way, and they're through, you know, they can cut through the bullshit and see the truth in much easier than we can, perhaps.
Yeah. I can. Do you want me to go back to the immigration, your original question about Israel, how their policy is sort of the opposite? I think it's true, like, people don't see that the Jewish powers have engineered our immigration laws, but this has been studied and published by Professor Kevin MacDonald in his book, A Culture of Critique. He explains how this is done. So to talk to someone in the street about this, you have to give them a bit of this background, that in 1965 there was a great change in immigration laws in the West, which allowed all this foreign immigration. But if you look at the history of it, it was all engineered by Jewish lawyers. And going back to like the 1880s, the Jewish lawyers were pushing for immigration changes, say in the United States, but the American people kind of held it fast to keep it proportional. So in 1924, they reaffirmed a policy of maintaining proportional immigration and keeping the balance about the same as it was. But all through this history, Kevin MacDonald's got the footnotes, the Jewish lawyers, they're persisting. You know, the Jewish supremacists were persisting. The 1965 under President Johnson, with, you know, Kennedy's proposal, they open up the immigration laws. So you can see what's behind it. So they create this open immigration for all the other countries. But for Israel themselves, they maintain the opposite policy, which is super critical. But yeah, like you're saying, your average person in the street in Europe will think, well, this is a Muslim invasion. The problem is the Muslims. But it was the Jewish supremacists that engineered this. So it does take some digging, so it's hard to communicate this to people.
I know.
You know, it's not so obvious.
Exactly. I remember reading a really good article, I forget the exact source now, but it was about how and why Sweden became multicultural, and it detailed basically from the 30s all the way up to the around 2010, I believe, and they show the demographic difference and whatnot from going from 1% of the population in Sweden in the 1930s were foreign-born, and I think the majority of those were actually from European countries. So extremely little in other regards. But from the 60s and then definitely like in the 90s, what this transformed, and the article broke down, you know, the various people involved in the promotion of this, from very small local press to very influential commentators like David Schwartz, who wrote a book on Swedish immigration policy and things like that. And it detailed basically just what you guys were talking about, and it made things really clear. But just as you say, this demands some investigation. It demands, you know, scratching the surface a bit and looking kind of who's behind it. And unfortunately, some people don't take the time to do that. So it's tricky.
Yeah, it's a tough sell. Like Alfred is saying, we have to market this to the average person in the street. We should think about ways to get the message across in sound bites. I often like I have an attachment of various sources I send to people. If they're interested, I can send them a quick attachment by email.
Right.
I mean, if you look at how they marketed the invaders, or basically coaxed them and encouraged them to come here, just to get some of the marketing points clear, is a lot of them really believe that they're coming up here and they're going to have a nice house, a nice car, maybe a nice girl. If they don't get that, they'll just grab the next girl that walks by, and you get the rape happening. And then they come here, and of course, then they don't get what they were promised. And they tell us, well, these are all refugees. See, so there's two different stories. They tell these people coming up one story. They tell us another story. They tell us these are refugees, but they are actually invaders. And these invaders came up because, hey, there's like something to be got for nothing up there, you know. And so now you're going to have massive frustration happening here. And this is the conflict that has been engineered by the hidden hand, which is, I won't say the word, you know, that's the hidden hand that we're talking about. And a lot of these people that are the invaders have paid like 10,000 euros or 15,000 euros to come up here. Now, who did they pay that money to? Well, it's probably the same people that are lending, you know, our governments the money. I mean,
the same people
that are running the opium trade in Afghanistan after we got that going again.
Yep.
You know, it's always the same people. And these same people have that all this money and that's the money they enslave us with. You know, and yet we all have the common enemy, if you want to call it that. And even the Jews themselves are being set up as a shield behind which the handful of perpetrators that are responsible for that are doing their dirty work. So all the Jews in Israel that are making their pilgrimages to Auschwitz and being taught all these lies are being set up in a very, very sinister plot. And they are going to be there as the human shield when humanity finally strikes out at the subjugator. And that's it's so predictable. It, you know, it's going to go that way. And our challenge is to get enough people to understand what's going on, to come back from the brink in with as little flow of blood as possible. But the
right.
course we're on, the trajectory we're on right now is for certain a complete total bloodbath, and there will be no winners. Certainly not Israel, certainly not the Jews. You know, and that's the whole thing.
Yeah, okay. So there's a couple of different things here. One is, of course, we have to recognize the historical aspect here, that this aspect of an antagonistic relationship, specifically between the European and the Jewish population, the Jews, has been one that has been on very shaky ground for a long time, right? That this is nothing new, basically. It's happened so many different times, and there seems to be a lack of kind of a self-examination, as you said, Alfred, as well, that it never seems to happen that they look in the mirror and ask, okay, what is it with our behavior that is pulling out this antagonism and these kinds of, you know, resentful emotions in the people that we're trying to, you know, dominate, basically.
I have to tell you a little story. I just read it in an Israeli newspaper. Unfortunately, I didn't save that page, so I have to skip over the details. But it was an Israeli newspaper, and apparently there's some kind of a little animal. It's kind of like a weasel or something like that. And to catch – this weasel does a really strange thing to catch the rabbit. This weasel does somersaults and dances around like crazy, and the rabbit apparently gets so mesmerized by this behavior that he doesn't run away and kind of just sits there. And so this little weasel animal is doing his flips and backflips and somersaults, getting closer and closer to the rabbit until he jumps at his jugular and gets him. And this rabbi wrote in this Israeli newspaper, he called this the European death dance, and he named it after this little weasel, because he says, here the Europeans are watching all these invaders coming in, not understanding that these invaders are going to jump at the jugular as soon as they get the chance. And just to confirm this analysis, our minister von der Leyen in Germany says that, well, for these migrants that are coming in, for these refugees, in order to equip them better for their future jobs when they go back home, we could put them in the Bundeswehr, like in the barracks, you know, with the military barracks, and they could get training there for future jobs when they go home. I says, what kind of nonsense is that? They're going to go in there to pick up their weapons and get training so they can shoot at us, because they know that you cannot get the Germans to shoot at Germans, and in fact, you probably cannot get Europeans to shoot on Europeans. But
yeah.
I don't think it'd be too difficult to get the invaders to shoot at us when
it
starts.
They'll train them as the police force or whatever. You know, I mean, not the, you know, those that are coming in this moment, of course. But in the long run, imagine if, I mean, they're already, you know, trying to diversify, so that's what they call it anyway, but imagine eventually when you have a, maybe a rulership, at least an enforcement arm of the elite in these countries that basically doesn't have any allegiance to the population. This can go in any direction if that actually happens. It's really terrifying thinking about that.
That's how they always do it. They always do it that way. They get people. That's how they did it in Russia. They would move, like, shift populations around to break up any loyalty to the people. If you cannot get Bavarians shooting on Bavarians, but you can probably have, you probably have no problem getting a bunch of Pakistanis or something to say, well, if you shoot these Germans, you're going to get their houses afterwards. You know, like you give them a reward, like you actually give them, reward them with, you know, with the possessions that are freed up once you shoot the population. I mean, this is a genocide against the Europeans that's taking place right now. And we are feeding those who are going to be killing us. That's what's happening right now. Just looking at the facts.
Or just say the example during Stalin's time, they would get people out of the gulags to go and invade Germany. They promised them, we can rape women, you know, as army women, and rape the German women. So they raped 2 million German women. And they were encouraged to join. They didn't have to use conscription. They were encouraged to join. People joined because that type of person would want to go and do that.
From 8 to 80, And, well, in Sweden, they're giving some of these incoming migrants, sniper lessons. I don't know if you guys caught the story.
Well, that's
it's hilarious. It's just, it's beyond belief, really. I looked at it. I just like shook my head. I can't believe it. But okay. So the other aspect of what I wanted to bring up there of the two points I mentioned earlier is the behavior of many of the migrants is like, okay, no, not everyone is a rapist. Of course not. It's not that simple. Maybe I wish it was, because then this would have been more clear cut, but it isn't. But nonetheless, the behavior of many of these people is, of course, they carry responsibility for their own behavior, right? That's what we have to recognize. And I wonder what lies behind that. I want to ask you guys what you think. Is at the root of this, or is this how they behave in their own societies, or is it that their inhibitions are released once they get to our liberalized, weakened, and frankly, you know, a system that lacks basically punishment, which is what they come from in many cases. They have a really hard government in place that are keeping many of these people in check of sorts, right? But that doesn't happen in ours. What's your take on this, guys?
Well, I think it might be a bit of both. Like in their own countries, more subjugation of women or using women. So when they come here, they project that, and also perhaps they feel they're encouraged to. Also, they feel, well, the Europeans just don't have it in themselves to defend themselves. Like, say, on New Year's Eve, the media and the police wanted to downplay that women were getting molested or groped. They didn't want to admit it. So that it kind of emboldens them, I think. So maybe they can realize they can get away with it. Plus, it's also part of their character, some of them, to do that because of their own culture.
Alfred?
Oh, yeah. But there's so many factors. And plus, just the fact that very many of those who are up here have actually been released out of African prisons and so forth, go up there, you know, wreak havoc up there. I mean, when you understand that they are not coming here because they are some kind of refugees, refugees usually come in. If you have real refugees, they will be happy for anything they can get and just be happy to have a secure place to live. But when you see, when you watch their behavior, it is anything but that. It reminds me more of people on a adventure trip to Europe. Paid a ticket to go to Europe, and now they want to get something for their money. That's what most of them are. Now, there's a very small percentage of them are legitimate refugees, and these legitimate refugees, of course, are going to suffer also because of the 90% of the others that are not legitimate. You know?
Yeah. Well, they cost their own people in some of these refugee centers. That's where it's actually the worst. The little children are raped and stuff there. It's horrible. So they turn on their own. They don't have that kind of, well, okay, maybe they would join up to, you know, to beat Whitey or whatever. But at the end of the day, it's not that super organized, really. It's more of an impulse thing that might, you know, help each other out over here in this instance, but in another instant they fight with each other and turn on each other too. Yeah. So it's very disorganized.
Yeah. But you have to understand this whole thing in the context of what it is, a deliberate destabilization of the entire European continent for that which is going to follow. And that, if you look at it, I encourage everyone to listen to Yuri Betsmanov's interview that he gave in 1985. It's in lots of different locations on the internet because everybody is finally figuring out how important that is. And really listen to that a few times and focus on what he says. And he says the destabilization will take normally between 2 to 5 years. In this case, what's happening in Europe, I think it's going to happen. The destabilization will reach a fairly high climax this summer when these people come out of their little caves and go out and do what they, you know, like rape and pillage and whatnot. And then there's some kind of a military crackdown. And that is why a lot of these people who already have military training, they know how to fight house to house, how to snipe people. We don't. They have the guns. We don't. Now we have hundreds of thousands of these guys who have gone undercover in Europe, and we don't even know where they are. They're not registered. They're somewhere. And they're not here for nothing. They're here for a reason. Because when this next phase enters, then things can really go from bad to worse in a very, very, very rapidly, and that's what's facing. And anybody who still calls them refugees and thinks we have to do something for them and is saying that, well, this next summer is going to be so many millions more, I said these people have got to come to terms with reality, because we are going into a collective suicide. Going back to this dance of death that the rabbi had written about, he had written that article and he wrote it as if he is an outside observer that has absolutely nothing to do with it, and was kind of like mocking us. He says, oh, look at the Europeans. Isn't that quaint? It reminds me of this, you know, and then he wrote that story, the dance of death. Europe is doing its dance of death. And he wrote it as if him and his tribe have absolutely nothing to do with it. And yet these are the people that are pulling the strings, orchestrating it all, and making money at every turn of the road. And that's the reality. So that's the challenge, how we deal with this reality and bring it back from the brink, wake up more people to understand it, and especially, I say, wake up people from the other side to come over to our side and take this down to a level of sanity. We have to stop the wars, stop the migrants, stop these invaders, send them all back home, and make it clear to them that they do not have a future here. Because when Europe starts to burn, I believe the Europeans will come out of their comatose state of delusion that they're in right now, and they will know what to do. And that would not be a very good time to be a fresh migrant anywhere on the streets, because you cannot predict today what the reaction is going to be when people realize what has happened to our beloved continent.
It's true. We really don't know, because we haven't really gotten our head into the fight on any level. And it might look like we are utterly, you know, pathetic and weak and useless and you know, not worth anything here, basically. But this could change rapidly and it could turn to bludgeon. Now, one of my kind of fears on top of this has been to express this idea that when and if this happens, I think it's a matter of time. I think it's when. How is the rest of the world going to react to that, right? Is the Africans and the Asians and maybe even the North Americans going to be armed and sent to Europe to, you know, to deal with the new rise of fascism that is on, you know, it's on the rise in Europe, right? That this could be one of the fixes that they're seeking to impose on us later.
I would believe that most people in their hearts would be glad and happy to see the Europeans finally get on their 2 feet and defend their territory, which is theirs. We do not have another home to run to if we lose this one.
Yeah.
And I think that people are waiting and yearning for the Europeans to stand up. Somebody has got to stand up to this Jewish supremacism, and Europe is probably one of the big hopes that there's going to be an internal, actually it's going to be a worldwide awakening that just brings that monster to a standstill. And then the big challenge is going to be to get away from this sick and broken financial system and replace it with something that has integrity and can work again, because our financial system is on the verge of complete and total collapse. When you've got so much more money out there than goods, and it's all basically been stolen, and people have been defrauded of this money, and one tiny little group has it all, then there's no validity in that money, you know? And that's what we have to, these are the challenges that we are faced with in the very near future. And if they lock up and eliminate all those people who have seen through the lies, what does that leave you? It leaves you with the criminals, the crooks, and a bunch of pathetic wimps that can't, you know, that don't recognize what the hell's going on. So it's only a matter of time before the monster is beaten, and now is the time to get all the people with integrity and courage and intelligence together to do it, and not the time to arrest them because they figured out the hollow hoax is a joke.
I wonder what percentage of people know the truth about the Jewish supremacists have hired. Like, is it only 10% of the population? Like, Hendrik, you were talking earlier about the historical backdrop going back 1,000 years, like the Jews have been kicked out of European countries about 109 times. And so if people wake up to it, like, will we turn against the Jewish supremacists again? I think that the mistake that the Jewish supremacists are making is they don't realize how much the Gentiles can take. They keep pouring on. They don't know how much we can take before we revolt. So they made this mistake in the past that Europeans would rise up and revolt. So, maybe that's their Achilles heel. Maybe they don't realize how much we can take. So I guess the question I was, how many people are aware of the hidden hand behind it? Like, they don't just blame it on the migrants, but they realize it was the international Jews behind it. Do you have any guess how many people actually know about this?
I think it's very low still.
But these are dynamic numbers, and they're changing as we speak.
Of course.
I just look at myself as an example. And I say, I knew just a fraction of what I know now if I go back 5 years, even 2 years, even 1 year. It's just amazing. Like, the learning curve of so many people is just on an exponential rise. And the quality of information that you can fall back on to increase the speed of this awareness is just also improving. I mean, if you look at what's available in the internet now, compare that to just a couple of years ago, there's no comparison, absolutely no comparison. And that is not going to stop, and it's not going to stand still. It is going to accelerate. And this whole thing is going to accelerate until it comes to some kind of a breaking point. And the breaking point, I've heard some very competent people here say, the breaking point will be when certain orders will be given to fire on certain people, and if you have Germans firing on Germans, or Germans are supposed to fire on British people, or Europeans on Europeans, whatever, that will be a breaking point. And I think we've already had a few breaking points. You know, didn't they just clear the thing in Calais there, the refugee camp in Calais or something like that, with bulldozers and stuff like that? And plus, there was a general in France who was arrested, and he said, I am ashamed to be French when I see what kind of traitors and treasonous criminals we have running our government. See, so there are more and more people every single day now standing up. Now, you might not see them all. You might not hear them because they will not be broadcast on the mainstream media, but the information is getting through that they are standing up, they are speaking up, just like we're having this dialogue right now. They haven't stormed into our house yet, even though I'm in Germany and I deny the Holocaust because it just did not take place. And I'm sorry, I will never, never bow to thought laws. If there was a law that said, on a windy day, stand on your head and piss into the wind, I would not do it because it was beneath my dignity. It is beneath my dignity to admit that there was a Holocaust when I know there wasn't. And everybody who has a functioning brain knows there wasn't if they look at the evidence.
I think it's a silent majority of people who are discontent, that's for sure, and many are probably waiting in the wings to show that. And that does demand leadership, of course, solid, good leadership. And maybe that's something we can actually talk a bit more about in the second segment here. I wanted to, this first hour just flew by here. I wanted to really just get some websites out for you guys and where people can go to find more of your work before we take a break, and then, you know, just pick up the conversation in the second. But Alfred, let's begin with you. Give us some of the details and tell us what you have available for people to dive into.
Well, I've done the videos I have made so far. The first one I made was after a dialogue I had with Noam Chomsky, and you can find that if you just do a search on 9/11 gatekeepers and then my name, Alfred Schaefer, and if that doesn't work, you add Noam Chomsky. Or it's on my channel, which is Alfred S. You know, that's, okay. And then my other videos are 9/11 brainwashing videos. And there, I think the one that helps, that could help people understand the where this story comes from. Because I take this all the way back to the Russian Revolution, and that is my Pavlov's dog. It's called 9/11 Brainwashing, Pavlov's Dog and Behavior Control. And that's also on my channel, which is Alfred S. We'll put a link on that afterwards beneath this video, I guess.
Definitely.
This program. And but I think there's also a number of links that we should encourage people to look at, including things like the Holodomor, which is the ethnic genocide of the Europeans, particularly in the Ukraine and so forth, going back into the Second World War. And that's all I can say for now, I guess.
Okay, very good. We'll make sure to have the links up so people can find more of your work. By the way, I looked at some of the earlier videos you made on Pavlov's dog and 9/11 and whatnot, and they're well produced and stuff like that. So I definitely urge people to check those out. So take a look at the channel. Okay, Brian, your turn.
I'd say my YouTube channel is just the Brian Rue channel. So just Brian Rue. Rue spelled R-U-H-E. So I've got actually hundreds of videos, and it's kind of varied. It began 7 years ago as a Buddhist meditation videos, and last 2 years or more about Jewish supremacy and revisionist history. So that's my main relationship with the world, I guess, is through my YouTube videos. I'm releasing some every week generally. Also, I have another website, ToolSociety.com. So this is based upon more of a spiritual interpretation of Adolf Hitler, National Socialism. It's a bit more of a esoteric focus. So that's ToolSociety.com. And my own Brian Rue website, just BrianRue.ca. But mainly it's my YouTube channel, Brian Rue channel.
All right, very good. I'd love to actually speak some more about that, the kind of spiritual component. And I guess as we get into leadership, that's a good time to talk about that. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, stay with us here. We'll take a short break as we do, and then we'll continue in the second for our members. Stay tuned.
They sentenced me to 20 years of boredom for trying to change the system from within. I'm coming now, I'm coming to reward them. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin. I'm guided by a signal in the heavens. I'm guided by this birthmark on my skin. I'm guided by the beauty of our weapons. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin. To my sister,
take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin.
I've been listening to Red Ice Radio. We come to you three times per week. We spare you from commercial interruptions, blinking ads and banners on the website. The first hour, always free, but we also have a dedicated site to our subscribers, our fans and supporters, where you can hear the second hour of this show and all our previous shows. We have everything archived there for you. You can also stream or download our videos, films, inside episodes, and much more. Go to redicemembers.com and check out our subscriptions that we have there for you. And by the way, before we pick up here in the second hour with Brian Rua and Alfred Schaefer, we have some really good shows coming up later. We have Sophia Smallstorm about the messy situation on how grants actually pay for the transformation of the West from immigration to the Agenda 21 style reformations that are occurring right now. It's all coming from banker money issued via grants. Pretty interesting stuff. We have Benton Bradbury, author of The Myth of German Villainy, coming up as well. We really fit in nicely with this show that we're doing today. We also have Stefan Jakobsson from the Party of the Swedes. We have Frank Richmond. We're going to do a show about the state of Australia and New Zealand as well to check in on what's going on down there. We are also going to talk about the Syria, Russia, Turkey, and of course, US-NATO situation that is developing in the Middle East as well. So we have some good shows coming up in the works, so definitely stay tuned to redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com for much more. But definitely join us in the members section if you want to hear the second hour of this show coming up. We're continuing the conversation with Brian Rua and Alfred Schaefer. Stay tuned, much more ahead.